tree of life. Bring on the rain, let the water roll down. Open up the sky, let the sun roll round. Soak it on up, let the fruit grow bright. And we're chilling in the shade of the tree of life. Bring on the rain, let the water roll down. Open up the sky, let the sun roll round. Soak it on up, let the fruit grow right. And we're chilling in the shade of the tree of life. Bring on the rain, let the water roll down. Open up the sky, let the sun roll round. Soak it on up, let the fruit grow right. We're chilling in the shade of the tree of life. Chilling in the shade of the tree of life. Chilling in the shade of the tree of life.
A lot of people who were here last time are not, which is to be expected because there's lots else to do, but some people here weren't here for the first part too. So I want to just kind of figure out how many people are in that category so I know how much to... Okay, the category of you were not here for part one. All right, quite a number of you. Okay, good. All right, so basically one of the things we did in the first hour was to make a list of the unconscious or conscious or just the habits of school. And I pointed out that they're not habits just of school, they're of our whole civilization. And in a lot of ways, they're intensified in school. But even if you didn't go to a normal school, these habits still might be present in your thinking and your habits, your way of being. And when the first part ended, I invited you to spend the next 3 hours while you have lunch and get into conversations and maybe go to another seminar to kind of observe yourself to see if you can notice any of these habits in operation, especially a habit that was unconscious to begin with but might have become conscious. Since there's so many of you who weren't here from the beginning, I'm just going to say give a few examples of these habits. And there's basically, you can think of them as being of two different types. There's habits of submission and habits of defiance. The habits submission
and
defiance.
Defiance.
Right. For example, a habit of submission would be to be punctual, to be on time all the time, and that's something we learned how to do in school, among other places. A habit of defiance would be to be never on time, to flaunt being late, and to procrastinate. Procrastination is also, you could contrast that with the habit of always doing as you're told when you're told to do it. To reflexively reject anything you're told is just as much a habit of school as it is to do everything you're told. The habit of looking outside yourself, looking to authority for answers, is definitely a habit of school. Another habit of school would be to automatically reject anything that comes from authority, to reject authority just because it's authority. So I notice that at this conference there's a lot of people who have the habits of defiance, which is probably a necessary stage in liberating ourselves entirely from the habits of school, and then we can be free. Well, I did the little lunchtime homework assignment as well, and I noticed in myself this habit of always wondering if something is allowed, if something's permitted. Is it allowed to do this? Is it allowed to do that? And so in some ways, I've rejected consciously these conventions. And so I have both a habit of submission and a habit of defiance in this area. My habit of submission is to be very tentative and very obedient and to only do what is expected, what is conventionally permitted, for example, in a situation like this. My habit of defiance would be to just flaunt convention, to act in unconventional ways just because it's unconventional, to refuse to shave, maybe, to refuse to wear nice clothes just because I'm not going to do it, you know, fuck you, that kind of thing. Like, that's a habit of school, saying, you know, fuck you to the teacher, right? That's just as much as to say yes, sir, to the teacher. Okay, and so I noticed while I was thinking about how to prepare for this part, that was one of the things that I noticed operating in myself. Another big habit, just to also get people thinking, another major habit, one of the most powerful of school, is to want to be seen as smart and right, to impress teacher. The habits of school get internalized. Initially, it's to impress teacher, and then in the future, it's to impress everyone around you and also to impress yourself, to give yourself credit and to give yourself a good grade. We also, in the first part, related it to fear, the habit of always being in fear and living in fear. And the origin of this fear in conditional approval and rejection, which is really survival anxiety. How modern parenting, and especially modern schooling, uses this to control and manipulate people. And then when we internalize it as guilt and shame, how we use it to control and manipulate ourselves. So deschooling is about liberating ourselves more than just from school, but also from these broader programs of control and ultimately the war against the self and the war against nature and the war against human nature that lies at the basis of our civilization. I'm not going to talk about that too much more right now, because I'd like to just open it up now to hear other people's reflections on their own unconscious habits, because, you know, like, we're all in a different place, and it really is helpful just for me personally to hear what other people have discovered in this process of deschooling themselves, because then sometimes, like, oh yeah, I do that, you know, and wow, and maybe I can stop doing that. How to stop, once you've realized it, is something I'll go into later on in this hour. So, and while we do this, I'm going to pass around this. If you want to be on my email list when I announce, like, publications and events and things, just write your name and your email address very clearly. Would anybody like to? Yeah.
If you're already on the list, do you have to put it on the mailing list?
No, if you're already on my mailing list, don't put your name on. Yeah. Yeah.
One thing that I'm really curious to hear what you think is, it seems like there's the rebelling or submitting, pretty much. What about a third option of acknowledging some kind of self-identity and going in harmony with that, rather than being against something?
Mm-hmm.
Or
yeah, I would say that wouldn't be a habit of schooling. I mean, that would be transcending a habit of schooling.
How so? Because I feel like you're looking interior to explore that. I mean, certainly using the reflection of the exterior, but it's not something that I would say I would learn in school. Maybe
No, it's not something you learn how to do, but it's, I mean, to me, that would be coming to terms with what has been unconsciously drilled into you through your schooling and no longer being subject to it. Unless I'm completely not understanding what you're saying. Does someone else really get what he's saying and can explain it?
Nobody gets me.
I kind of get it.
Okay.
Well, I think, tell me if I'm wrong, because
sure,
I kind of have... It's the extremism of it's got to be either a negative or a positive almost, and it's like finding...
Yeah.
Or a negative and a negative.
Yeah, I think it seems like a negative and a negative. Either you're being brainwashed or you're rebelling against.
Well, it's pretty much like there's... I mean, conditioning just happens in any way, shape, and form. So it's always happening, regardless of what path you choose, unless you have the answer to this, which I haven't read your book. And I don't know if this is exactly what you're talking about, but you know, how do you avoid conditioning? I guess is by can you avoid it by finding an inner peace and just trusting your own self and pulling on your own resources? That's kind of what I was thinking. thought you would.
Yeah, yeah. That's along the lines.
Anna, do you want to?
Well, I think that, like, what I got from what you were saying is that it's, at least my own take on it is that, you know, everything, we're all influenced by everything. And school is such a large part of many people's, you know, formative years that it is also a large influence. But the reality is we're always influenced by everything. And it's not about bad or good. It's about being able to kind of remove the layers, examine them, and say, ooh, do I want this or do I not want this?
You know?
And I think that it's so... Yeah, I mean, I think that it's not necessarily, you know, school is bad. But anyway, can I give an example of deschooling myself?
Yeah.
Because I dropped out of school when I was 14. I'm 17 now. And the biggest thing that I went through that I had to get rid of was this idea that that I had to be with people, kids my own age, with peers all the time, every day, or else I was unsocial, I wasn't cool. I would get, you know, it was the parents and it was the TV and it was everything saying teenagers are social creatures and if you're not social, there's something wrong with you. And I had to, I found out that I was actually, I consider myself an introvert and I enjoy spending time alone. And I wasn't lonely, but I thought I should be lonely because that's what everyone seemed to be telling me. Because everyone says, well, what about the social life and what about this? And it seemed that it was the process of removing agendas from other people. And school can be a very large, one big agenda, just like other, you know, workspaces and everything like that. And the way that I was able to come to peace with it was I discovered the word yes, which is such a simple word, but it's my favorite word in any language, because I realized that when you're fighting with something, sometimes all it takes is a yes. That sounds so simple, but yes to my flaws, yes to my strengths, yes to this layer and yes to that layer, and it becomes a beautiful, and you can, you know, express an artwork, and I'm kind of jumbling up my thoughts here because I'm still trying to articulate it, but I found that deschooling sometimes can be really stressful if you put the stress on yourself, but it can also be a really wonderful experience of exploration and, like, being with yourself and... coming and saying yes to yourself as you are, with all the layers of influence and without the layers of influence.
Mm-hmm. So, one sec. Is what Matthew is asking, are you asking whether it's possible to not get influenced? Or are you asking,
well,
are we not getting influenced?
No, I don't think that that's possible. However, I do feel like after you have a lot of influence, certainly you're always going to have this influence, but when you're a child, you're more susceptible to this influence because everything is a stimulus. Everything is always a stimulus. However, when you have a more independent focus on you as a self-actualized individual, you can ascribe more faith to your interior concept of identity, where you can have these experiences however they get filtered through, and they always do, but when we're younger and we have less of a degree of identity, then there's more of a exterior influence than there is an interior influence, and once we matriculate into this realm of some kind of strong self-identity, then we are doing less of a submission or acquiescence as much as we are a volitional movement.
Well, I think that, okay, I'm not sure how too deeply I want to get into this particular conversation. I think a lot of what we think of as volitional is actually just the internalization of external control, and that we don't have as much free will as we think.
I want to learn about that.
Yeah. That's cool. But also, the other thing that was coming up for me as you spoke was that just because something's a habit of school doesn't mean it's bad. You know, it might be something that serves us very well. And we might examine it and say, yeah, you know, I want to keep that habit. So it's not about categorically rejecting everything that comes from school, which in itself might be a habit of school to say, okay, everything's either right or wrong as answers are on tests. And that's one of the habits that I like to let go of that doesn't serve me very well anymore, the habit of labeling everything right and wrong and having to come to a judgment about everything. Instead of sometimes perhaps just to feel something and withhold offering to myself a judgment or an analysis. I want to have somebody speak who is ordinarily shy about speaking but has something really valuable. Would anybody like to take advantage of that invitation. Is that you?
I think so. At this point, you go up and down. It's a roller coaster. I just wanted to say to you saying that I think there's a way of bringing together all these things that I call reconciliation. When you reconcile apparent opposites, then you move forward, you create something completely new, which is yours.
Yeah.
Kind of like a sailboat. You know, a sailboat has the resistance of the water and of its own inertia, but the wind wants to move it. But then you have the, sail and the rudder and all that stuff. Yeah. And if you reconcile these two apparent opposite forces, you can get it to go in any direction, including almost into the wind. So if you could take, you know, that the submission, the defiance, and all of that, reconcile them some kind of way, then they become yours.
Okay. Yep. Kathy, you had a comment too.
I was just going to give you an example.
Thank you. Yeah.
I ended up having lunch with somebody who was in one of the workshops. We got into a school discussion, and at one point I offered, it just felt like a back and forth in terms of what we were talking about. It felt like we were both on the same page, and then I offered a piece of information that I realized didn't sit well, or he just didn't respond in the same way, like yes, yes, mm-hmm. yes. So I realized, but what came up for me was, oh, that was wrong. I did the wrong thing, and here we were having a nice conversation.
Mm-hmm.
And so then I thought about it afterwards, and I thought it didn't resonate with him.
Yeah,
so that wasn't right. That wasn't wrong. But I really had this deep feeling of, oh, it was wrong.
Yes.
I lost this connection with him, that we were having this nice conversation.
Right.
And then we went on to something else, and we talked about something that seemed like we're on the same page again.
So the habit
would... Why we would have to always be on the same page about things?
Mm-hmm. That could be a habit of school.
Right?
Yeah, a habit of school would be wanting approval from your peer group, or wanting approval from whatever authority is there. Yeah, so definitely a habit of schooling. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, Khalif.
When I got here, I realized that even though I didn't do the assignment, a habit of school played out right here in my seat as I was thinking about the fact that I hadn't done the assignment.
Yeah.
And I was thinking, well, should I kind of reverse engineer a response to this and think about what happened and try to come up with it now?
Yeah, yeah.
Maybe I should, you know, what would people think if I don't have an example that shows that I was studious and attentive to the assignment?
Right. For me, one thing that, you know, even giving an assignment is something that I have to overcome some resistance, because my extreme reaction to the control of school was to, oh, I'm not ever going to give anyone an assignment, you know, and or impose my will upon a group, you know, and set a direction and stuff, you know, I'm going to be democratic and everything. And now I'm coming back to maybe more of a, I wouldn't say balanced, I'd say free, you know, where I feel free to do what I want to do. Being free to do what you want. I mean, that's one of the really deep things that school teaches you against, you know, that you can't just do what you want. Yeah.
Teacher and student.
One of the things that, you know, I was thinking, I was thinking, what's going on? And I was in a discussion with a couple other people, and I said, I'm still trying to figure out what I want to do when I grow up. And that's still, like, really a big question every day. It's like, I'm doing some stuff, but is this really what I want to do? What do I
do? Yeah.
I really was taught not to figure that out, but to just keep following until I got to the end of it. Then what? Now what?
Although I would say that the idea if you've got to figure out what you want to do when you grow up is also an ideology of school, if not a habit of school. Like, since when does anybody who does what they love actually figure it out? Figure it out. Think of that phrase, that figure of speech, to figure out. What it really means is that you're going to add up, you're going to quantify things, you're going to add up all the numbers, and you're going to literally figure out through analysis and logic what you're going to do. Where'd that come from?
There are books about it.
Yeah, you know, you're supposed to weight everything. Here's how to make a decision. You assign a number of value to all of the pros and cons, and you add them up. And whatever option has the highest pros and the least cons, in government, it's called a cost-benefit analysis. And that's really making choices from the mind instead of from the heart, which says, I don't care what the cost-benefit analysis says. I just know it's wrong to cut down this forest, and I'm not going to do it no matter what. That's not something we learn in school, to trust our instincts. We learn to trust these abstractions. So that could be another habit of school, trusting in abstractions. And what I was talking about the first time about principles, living according to principles, again, that's something that's coded very deeply in our pedagogy. Any other? Yeah, Regina.
Somebody was talking about you were talking about doing what you want to do, and one of the things that I am working on in my de-schooling of myself process is thinking about my needs. Mm-hmm. I don't know if I was taught that they don't matter or if I was not taught that they do matter, but I'm working on identifying what is a need versus a want, and what's the relationship between what I want and what I need.
Uh-huh. Yeah, it's fairly acceptable to say I'm going to learn to meet my needs and what my needs are. It's a little less acceptable to say I'm going to learn to meet my wants.
Yeah.
And I'm going to really indulge those.
Yeah,
and
I don't know if I'm even there yet. I'm working on finding out what's a need, and do I want what I need? Is that why I want it? Or do I want it for some other reason?
I have another seminar that delves into this in a lot of depth, but basically the basic principle is that wants come from unmet needs, and that it feels good to meet your needs, and that an unmet need hurts. Really simple. That's why if you hold your breath for a minute, it hurts, and then when you breathe, it feels good. Very basic. But that's a little off topic. But yeah. Yeah, thank you. Yeah.
Well, it has to do with ego and like measuring myself against other people. Mm-hmm. So I think there's like this calculator that's constant, like a cash register that's sort of always in the background operating, like in the background of your computer, saying that, well, I have more of something than he has, or mm-hmm. he has, or less of something than he has.
Yeah.
And I don't know if that just comes from school or, you know, somewhere else, but it's prevalent. And I think in it's like a kind of mindfulness to try to just notice that and observe it and
you know,
just
mm-hmm.
be aware.
Yeah. Yep, this is, yeah.
From a session where I realized I was one of the few people who did not speak, which is not like me, and then I also said, well, that doesn't look right if I don't say something.
Mm.
You participate, you should mm-hmm. contribute.
Yeah, it's hard for us to grok the depth, I mean, how impactful it is to be in a setting where you're always being evaluated. That's, you know, the teacher's there, and the teacher's going to give you a grade which you associate with your future success in life, you know, and anything could be part of that grade. So you're always on display, you know, you're always performing. That is such a burden, you know, and it gets so deeply ingrained.
So basically what we're talking about, what you were saying right now, what you're saying, I'm basically resurrecting what we have briefly discussed in the previous session, is not so much about de-schooling as it is about maybe de-socializing.
Yeah.
A better word.
Yep.
I mean, school is just one of the devices which
right.
acts for a particular function that society has.
Yes.
Enculturation.
Yep.
Enculturation. So it's not just mm-hmm. school, it starts with the way the mother feels about the child in her.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
That's where it starts.
Yep, it's part of de-civilizing ourselves. I'm going to say a little bit more about that, but definitely.
Yeah.
It's much bigger than school. And school can't change without changing everything else. It's impossible to change one thing without changing everything.
Yeah, school is just representing that whole
system. Right. Yep. Yes. Anna?
Well, I was going to add on to that because I was having trouble with your language, and I just wanted, I felt like I needed to say something, but I think that I really struggle at things like this because there's so much anti-school talk, and it's hard, and I don't know. I wish we could make that distinction in the language just because I've had good experiences at schools and some other people have had good experiences at schools, and I think that it can't be that black and white, and talking about it that black and white doesn't feel right to me, and I don't know if there's another way that we can address it, but it's not, I think it's a really good point. It's not simply de-schooling, it's de, it's true, it's finding truth within ourselves and, doing what's right for us as opposed to all the influences of other people. So it's more, it seems like it's more about, connecting with what we want and who we are and our needs and how we can meet those needs, mm-hmm. And remove the external influences that we don't want.
Influence is not a bad thing.
That's right. You could imagine. I mean, I can imagine.
No, and that's what you're saying.
I can imagine, and I do imagine situations. I mean, what is a school anyway, right? But so situations where adults and children are interacting, and the purpose is exactly what Anna was saying. The purpose of these interactions is, like, consciously to create situations where people can come in contact with their needs, where children can learn what their needs are, what their wants are, what their passion is, who they really are in this world, and then have the resources and opportunities to express and enact those discoveries. And you could call that a school, and it would be a beautiful thing. And to some extent, you can find this in school already. You can find this in the worst public school in the country. There is still a tiny little, because everything that's negative and harmful and destructive in our civilization also has a spark of spirit, a spark of a beautiful spirit and the seed of a more beautiful world. And there's, any school you go to, there's committed teachers who really love kids and who really want what's best for them. And within even the worst teacher, there is that tiny little spark of that desire, too. I think it's important to see that, to see the beauty in all things that's there, at least in a germinal form, and to speak to that. Like Gandhi said, he said, speak to their reason and conscience. See somebody as, I know you really want to do the most beautiful thing. And maybe you think that you can't, maybe it feels impossible, maybe you're afraid to, but, and you don't necessarily say that out loud, right? But you see people with those eyes, and that creates a space where it can begin to blossom, and someone will maybe make that choice. So I agree not to categorically demonize school, and it is just a word. Yeah.
Is there a better word we could use, like a replacement word? I don't know if anyone else feels. I know you want to say that.
No, because then you keep going from one word to another, and you get into this PC kind of.
I know. I don't want to make it too PC. I'm just wondering.
We'll have a metaphorical asterisk next to.
Yeah.
Okay.
I see it as ending, as really ending the war against the self. School is part of the age of separate school as we know it. Is part of the age of separation, the age of control, the age of the war against nature. The war against nature and the war against human nature. You can really trace its origins back to agriculture, back to domestication, and symbolic culture. These are what began the distancing process from nature, where we began to see nature as an other, and began to distinguish between good and evil. With agriculture, for example, all of a sudden, instead of this unbroken, harmonious system of nature, all of a sudden the wolf is bad and the cow is good. The weed is bad and the vegetable is good, and you begin to distinguish. And then you have good weather and bad weather. And
is that not natural, though?
Is what not natural?
To think of things as good and bad. I mean, certainly the antelope thinks of the jaguar as bad.
Not necessarily. Maybe he just thinks of him as dangerous.
Yeah, yeah.
Isn't it?
Not necessarily bad. I mean, even now, if you go to tribal communities, they don't consider a stormy sky as bad weather. They just consider it as weather.
Yeah.
Another form of weather.
Right.
They're not dependent in any way with that weather happens.
But they are. I mean, sometimes, if you have crops,
like, I
think
the
and you have a drought.
Yeah.
But when you're having crops, you have to have a particular pattern to your life, to your weather, to everything. You need to be able to control the weather, which you can't. So you control your systems according to
what
you know the weather to be like. But in a tribal situation, you don't need to do that. You go with the flow.
If it's a pre-agricultural tribe, yes. And this is a huge topic. Okay, it's in the Ascent of Humanity. It's and that chapter is like 80 pages. I mean, it's the origins of separation. It's called. But really, what I was saying is that school is just one expression of the ordering and management and domination of nature, because it says, you know, and I'm again talking about school as it's normally practiced today, but it says, you know, we cannot accept the unmolded child. The child's natural impulses must be overcome. We have to teach children to overcome their natural impulses. So we set up this system of controls and rewards and punishments. And you will develop good work habits and good study habits. And after you've done all your homework, then you can go out and play, but only after. And, you know, when I was in fourth grade, I complained to my math teacher that long division was boring. I'd actually invented long division in third grade, but they told me I couldn't do that yet. And then, so my parents took up the issue, had a meeting with the teacher, and the long and short of it was that she said, if he's bored with this long division, because I had to do page after page of it, you know, same thing again and again, she said, that's good. It's good that he's bored because he's going to be bored a lot in life, and this is preparation for it. And it's really just the overcoming of certain parts of the human spirit, of validating things because they're hard. Here's another habit. Validating things because they're hard. If I said, you know, it would have been really easy for me just to give that guy the finger, but I didn't do it. I'm congratulating myself on not doing the easy thing. Easy equals bad, hard equals good. That's an ideology of school that's never said out loud, and it is very, very pervasive. You'll probably notice yourself saying, it would have been really easy, or it's just easy to do such and such, as a synonym for bad.
Well, isn't there some relation, though, to challenging versus hard?
Yeah.
But isn't there worth in challenge and self-challenge and then feeling proud that you've overcome challenge?
Yeah.
But yeah.
Yeah.
I think the language is the issue, where it's like the good and the bad and how people perceive those things. Like, because everything, like you're talking about the storm and stuff, like, everything has, like, a balance and there are things that go wrong, but going wrong doesn't make it necessarily bad.
Mm.
You know, and I think, like, that's where Charlie's at, like, the good and the bad and how people perceive good and bad, because essentially there is no good and bad. Everything just is. And you
Yeah.
The way you take it.
A lot of it is in language. A lot of times when people use hard to refer to challenge, what they really mean is scary. Yeah. Yeah.
I think maybe just also the distinction of challenge.
Mm-hmm. One thing that this workshop, the seminar, is really about is simply to make things that were unconscious conscious. That in itself creates movement and creates change. Because a lot of times people will say, okay, now I've noticed some ways that I've been unconsciously enacting the habits of school. Now what can I do about it? I've got to do something about this. And I've got to stop doing this. And it can set up this struggle, which is usually unnecessary. Usually simply becoming aware of something already causes a change. And you'll find yourself acting in different ways automatically and effortlessly without struggle. Anyone else like to share a...
I'm curious to hear what you think about this. It kind of goes back to the figuring things out and assigning values and whatnot, but I was talking to a kind of higher-ranking military guy, and he was in charge of sending people, in certain spots to go into battle. And I was just blown away by that responsibility. Mm-hmm. I said, you know, how do you determine how you do things and the responsibility inherent in the decisions that you make? And he says, I take all the information that I have accessible and I use my mind and make up a decision, and then I listen to my heart and see how I feel, and then I go with my gut.
Hmm.
And I was wondering where the gut comes into this.
Hmm. Wow.
Sounds like BS to me.
No, that rings true to me. There's something about that rings true to me.
Where the gut comes in, that intuition, that inner feeling that says, maybe my heart says this and my mind says this, but I'm going to go this way instead.
Like, my personal opinion, is it always exists, like, most of the time you just snuff it out with your heart or your mind, and, like, you use those as something to cover up your gut feeling? Because typically you see them as better
orientation. Sometimes, certainly, they're in harmony, though.
Right.
Yeah, the Asian alchemists had a way to look at this whole thing. They divided the human being into three parts: head, thorax, and abdomen, where the head, symbolized alchemically by silver, was cool, still, and reflective. The heart and the lungs, symbolized by gold, were warm and not still, but rhythmic. And they had some other properties too. And then the gut, symbolized by sulfur, was hot and transformative. And the function of the head in the system was simply to reflect. The function of the heart was to know and to choose. And the function of the gut was to transform, to change. And one way to look at what's happened in our civilization is that the functions of the head have invaded everything else, where we try to, it takes the place of the heart in trying to choose and to know when it's really supposed to just reflect, and to take over the functions of the gut when we're trying to act and change from the head. Physiologically, the results of this invasion are the stillness of the head invades the rest of the body as tumors, sclerosis, cysts, stones, and other hardenings. And sometimes when people let go of control in this mental world, these conditions can clear up. Yeah.
My response had to do with the result, not with the process, and I guess that's what I was interested in. Does that mean that you can use the same process? I'm not objecting to the process, but you can use the same process to decide how to murder your spouse. Is there anything about the process that matters in terms of
okay, I think we come to access deeper and deeper levels of desire, and yes, you can apply it to, like, you can apply these basic principles of, and we're really kind of getting off the track a little bit, but of basically it's self-trust, and you can apply it to your job as an accountant for a Fortune 500 company. And over time, what will happen is that the things that you were passionate about and that felt right to you no longer feel right. And when you get into a habit of trusting those feelings and being courageous about acting on them, that's a new habit, then eventually you'll come to the point where you'll be like, I'm not going to do that anymore. Because you trust yourself deeply enough and you've seen the results of it before. So it doesn't have to be this heroic thing, where whether it's, you know, you might see like your whole life, your whole profession, as your whole way of being as just like the crystallization of what we've been calling the habits of school, which are really the habits of culture or civilization. And oh my God, how am I going to get out of this? My whole life is based on security. My whole life is based on getting a good grade. My whole life is based on pleasing authority, being smart, and being right. What am I going to do about this? How can I get out of this? I want to bust out. And that can seem like an impossible task, because when you really admit it to yourself, you know, hey, you know, you might say, I'm afraid to go without health insurance, or to even risk my health insurance, or to even risk my job, and I just can't get there. So the good news is that this deschooling process unfolds in a natural progression of stages, and that the step to take at any one time, A, it naturally manifests, and B, it'll be something on the edge of your courage and not beyond it. If the necessary step is beyond your courage, then what will happen is that you will unconsciously engineer it via some kind of accident, getting fired, or some other catastrophe. So you don't have to worry about it. If what is needed is beyond your courage, then you'll take care of it unconsciously. Otherwise, which might be painful, but otherwise, you'll maybe even tomorrow, you'll have something on the edge of your courage that corresponds to the realizations that you have in this deschooling process. So Carlos has been persistently raising his hand, so.
Going back to the question that was asked about the gut and the heart and all of this other stuff, I don't think we make decisions cognitively. All that cognition can do is get us as much information as possible. Once you get that information, then you've got to go with what I call affective perceptive. The mind has at least three different kinds of processes: the cognitive, the affective perceptive, and the pragmatic, practical action to do. Sometimes the affective perceptive is what people call intuition. So let's call it intuition to make it easier. You gather as much information as possible, then you've got to feed that into your intuition, because intuition without information is just berserk. You know, you just do crazy things. But, you know, information or decisions made totally cognitively is, you know, what Charles was saying about, you know, it's a linear mechanical way of just kind of adding it up mathematically and saying this is, but it's not a real decision. The real decision is fed by the cognition, all the information you can possibly gather up, and then your intuition has to take over.
Okay, I just want to halt for a second here, because I'm noticing a habit of school that's being invoked, which is, okay, it's basically tell me what to do. Give me the information on, it's that the way to do something is to find the information and then to put it into practice, right? Like there are other ways. In fact, that probably rarely happens that way. But that's one of the habits that we've learned in school, and now we're trying to apply it to personal liberation or something like that. You know, find the information, and once I understand the information, then I can use it and produce it. I mean,
no, that's not what I'm saying.
I know it's not what you're saying, but that's what the information you're providing was feeding into for me. I know you're not. I'm not saying you're advocating that. But what I'm saying is,
information anywhere.
Yeah.
It doesn't have to be from books or whatever.
Right.
You have to understand it. Let me put it that way. You have to understand what it is that you're dealing with.
Yeah, I'm not actually addressing what you were saying as far as the content was. I was addressing it as far as the how it was impacting me and how
popular perception.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Because I want to stay really focused here. Yeah.
I want to address what he said.
All right.
It's not that way for me. It's the opposite way for me. First, I get the intuition. Then I get the information. Okay.
I think
it might be normal, but
a lot of times, what we think of as reasons are actually rationalizations and justifications for what we want to do anyway. That's.
I think yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. I think we're on the same page there. Okay. Is anybody? I'd like to hear one more. Like something that will really. Inspire me that someone has discovered that they were unconscious about that now they're conscious about. A habit of school or a habit of civilization.
Could you make a list of the things that inspire you so that I can think about it?
Yeah.
Respond based on my intuition.
Yeah. Yeah.
How to say it so the teacher's impressed, because you don't exactly repeat the same words. It's
right.
Correct.
Last year I gave kind of a preliminary version of this, and I just, there was fewer people, so I had people introduce themselves with your name and something that makes you laugh and something that makes you cry. And I said, for real, like, you know, something that actually has made you laugh and actually has made you cry in the last 6 months. And many people, though, despite that instruction, still gave this kind of theoretical discourse on what is sad in the world, but didn't actually talk about didn't actually tell anybody what actually made them cry. And I thought that was an interesting illustration of the habits of school, where you don't really get engaged, but you pretend to be engaged. Mm-hmm. Yeah, bullshitting, that's a good word for it, isn't it?
I have some kind of realization.
Yeah.
For the first time, I'm just really thinking about if people that did well in the public school that I went to were in some ways more intelligent or in some ways more able to be molded.
Oh, yeah. Definitely. I think it's... I mean, I did very well in public school. You know, I was... got all kinds of honors and stuff, and I went around thinking that I was smarter than everybody else for a long time until I realized that the really smart kids, I mean, to the extent that smart has any utility at all, the really smart kids were the ones who saw through that, maybe even unconsciously. And they didn't waste their time learning the state capitals. And they knew, as I did not know, that it doesn't matter what Hernando de Soto did or who the whatever president of the United States was. They knew that it was junk knowledge. They had the intelligence to see through this facade, this lie that this is actually useful. And I was too stupid. I was, and this is just one version of reality, but I was more easily broken. And I submitted, and, you know, again, you get a document that says, has submitted, and eventually you get a teaching certificate, which the teaching certificate says has submitted and been broken so much that this person can be counted on to break other people and make them submit. And so, yeah, like...
The smartest kids are the ones who drop out.
What turned the light on for me? Well, it was a few things. I mean, for one thing, like, I kept producing the right answer, sometimes in 600-page format, and I never did get credit for it. I never did get my rewards that I had unconsciously assumed I would get, you know. And also, I just saw other people being more effective in their social relationships, in their work, and not just in making money, but in creating the beautiful world that I want to help create, doing wonderful things with their hands and with their minds. And I wasn't doing it. And part of it also, was that I saw that, I mean, I just saw through the whole motivation of school, the whole motivating program of, when I read Lewis Mumford and people like that about just about the foundations of civilization and the project to build a tower to heaven. The front cover of my book, The Ascent of Humanity, is a painting of the Tower of Babel, a 16th century painting, which I see as a metaphor for this attempt to create, well, on the collective level, to create utopia by building a human realm that's higher and higher, more and more separate from Earth and from nature. Perhaps through the perfection of technology, through the perfection of nanotechnology and computers and the virtual world, and through social technologies of more and more laws, more and more regulations, more and more ways of controlling behavior, social engineering. And then in the personal world, self-perfection, trying harder, techniques to motivate yourself. And the mythology says that someday, you know, if you try hard enough and build high enough, you will finally reach heaven. And this program is falling apart in our time, which has to happen. the higher you build, the more energy is required and the more effort's required even to prevent it from collapsing. The sky remains ever as distant. You know, in the age of coal, I mean, this is, and if you read some of the early writings on education too, you know, they were going to build a perfect world. They were going to take these young minds, you know, and make them into something that their parents could never make them into. They were going to, the utopian writings from Plato on basically say we're going to take the young away from their parents and we're going to educate them scientifically. This is part of creating this perfect world. So even, and then in the material realm too, you know, in the age of coal, they were saying that work will soon be obsolete. Now we have machines, and each machine does the work of 1,000 men. So in 20 short years, each man will only have to work 1,000th as hard. But what did we get? We got the 16-hour workday instead in the age of coal. Why? Well, we haven't actually built high enough. It's the age of electricity that will usher in technotopia. Oh, actually, no, it's actually atomic power. No, it's the computer. No, it's nanotechnology, genetic engineering, biomedicine, right? One promise after another. And yet, are we any closer to utopia now? Are people any happier? Is life any more enchanting than it was 50 years ago, 100, 1,000 years ago? It's not. The sky is as far away as ever. What's happening in our age is that we're in the midst of a convergence of crises as the effort to even maintain the tower and its foundation becomes overwhelming. We can't build any higher. So we have crises converging in every area, you know, ecological, energy, water, food, medicine, and education. And in the, what I foresee is that organizations, groups, meetings like this, we're pioneering new ways of new kinds, not just new technologies, new social technologies, but new kinds of technology that are not based on control, that are not based on the struggle to overcome evil and the war against nature and the war against the self, and that the social and material edifices that we will build will be built for beauty and not height. Because, as a matter of fact, another part of the Babel metaphors, you know, where does the sky, where is the sky anyway? You know, it's an inch off the ground. It's all around us anyway. It's just a shift of perception away. So the new paradigms of schooling, which we're just beginning to explore, I mean, my kids go to basically a Sudbury type of democratic free school, which I have some serious issues with. I don't think that it's the have-all and end-all of what a school can be. Same thing with Montessori, same thing with Waldorf. See lots of really beautiful things. I think we're just beginning to figure out what this particular social technology will be in the age of reunion. I call it the age of reunion because here we're in the age of separation that I talked about the first time where you know, I talked about how school as we know it is an outgrowth of the human sense of self in the modern age where we're separate, discrete beings. I'm separate from you and you're separate from you and we're all separate from the world. And if that is, right, and it's in economics, it's in biology, it's in religion, and if that's what you believe, then essentially we are all in competition with each other. More for me is less for you. And that's the basic fact of biology, the basic fact of economics that we have to overcome with this conditioning and with the civilizing because we're fundamentally evil. The total depravity of man is the phrase that I like from John Calvin. And so this paradigm of control is a completely natural, unavoidable outgrowth of that sense of self. But that sense of self is collapsing now because the civilization that we've built upon it is collapsing. It's not working anymore. It's not sustainable. And that's becoming more and more obvious. The collapse invades our personal lives as various kinds of catastrophes that are caused by social breakdown, physical breakdown, health breakdown, and ecological breakdown more and more. And these will continue. And in the ruins, amidst the ruins of the old world based on the old sense of self, the world of separation, the age of reunion will grow. We are already planting the seeds. That's why the work that we're doing in Arrow is so important, because not because we are going to be able to overcome the system that exists right now, but we're planting seeds that will grow, because when it does, this is just my view, that when the educational system collapses, which will be connected to the collapse of everything else, then people will be like, okay, so what do we do now? And there will be pre-existing models that we are trying out right now, that people in this room are trying out. And we'll say, well, this works pretty well, you know, and that works pretty well. It's Waldorf, you know, Sudbury, you know, and these things work pretty well. And we'll have, and people are doing this in education, people are doing this in economics, people are doing this in engineering, every realm. The seeds of the new world are growing, or at least they're ready to germinate. And I guess today we've been talking more about the personal level. I think that most people have discovered in their lives that real changes do come after a kind of a collapse, when the old self just isn't working anymore. And conversations like this maybe are equivalent to planting the seeds of, you know, even if it doesn't resonate with you, or if it's like, well, yeah, that sounds nice, but, you know, come on, like, I'm not going to make any real changes now. But they are seeds that will grow when the time has come. And there's nothing necessarily that you have to do about it right now.
You've been listening to a recording of a seminar on deschooling given by Charles Eisenstein, author of The Ascent of Humanity. If you're a new listener, you can hear the entire reading of Charles Eisenstein's book, The Ascent of Humanity, in the Unwelcome Guests show archive at unwelcomeguests.org, and visit his website at ascentofhumanity.com. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thank you for listening.
One day and they'll kill me, then I'll be gone, but that won't be my end, for my guns and my saddle will all